Last several weeks, last week going through taxation in the colonies, the week prior to that going through British civic law, the week prior to that, I don't even remember. What was it? The Enlightenment, thank you. Yeah, I didn't even remember. So all of that is really foundational to what we have to know background-wise and historically. So this week is a lot more application as we study certain historical events. So while all of the lessons have been historical in nature, this one is very heavily historical and requires a lot of recall of what we've already gone over because of, like I said, that application. So from a legal standpoint, if you're a lawyer, and you have the British and King George III, or if you're a judge, and you have British and King George III as the plaintiffs, and you have the founding fathers as the defendants, how are you going to rule this case? Who is on the side of the law? Because if we can determine which side is lawful, which side is actually following legal guidelines, then we can understand and critique both sides and say, this side is correct in this way or in these several ways, but might be incorrect in this way. And we can come to the ultimate conclusion, which is the title of everything that I'm doing over the, I think, 6 or 7 weeks that I have been teaching and will be teaching, and that is it justified from a legal standpoint? If it is justified from a legal standpoint, how much different does that make than our introduction into pastors' Sunday school? So if we already can say, yes, legally we can justify it or we can't justify it, well, that kind of leads us to, okay, from a biblical standpoint, you're already kind of either getting off on the right foot or getting off on the wrong foot. Okay, so taxation in the colonies was yesterday or last week, and we talked about the several different taxes that were passed, and for sake of time and the amount of content that I need to get through today, if you can recall those on the past sheets that we've handed out, that's fine. But we're going to move on as though you already kind of had that fresh in your mind. So the introduction here, how can disobeying the authority of a government become the legal and moral obligation of a people? And this is very heavily applicable to us. The 2020 election, there's still audits. My understanding that there's still some audits, especially in the state of Arizona, that's taking place. If you have a government that is operating illegally, is that even possible? Because from a lot of people's point of view, the government is the law. And what the government says and what the government does is therefore legal. Is that actually the case all the time? In a constitutional government, it's not. And even during this time, Britain was more slanted towards a constitutional monarchy than just about every other monarchy in the Western world at the time. So the law was of utmost importance. Okay, so if the authority of the government becomes illegal, then whose responsibility is it to make sure that their actions are legal? Is it just, do we just leave that to God? And that would be something that pastor would, a question that he would have to answer. Do we leave that to God and just continue to do what we're supposed to do as Christians? Or from a legal standpoint, is it actually our obligation, not just our obligation, but our legal right to then become the enforcers of the law? And that's something we need to look at. So the Boston Tea Party is something we didn't get to last week, and so I want to start with that. This is 1773. It was organized by the Sons of Liberty, which is an organization headed up by Samuel Adams, the brother of John Adams. And they're based out of Boston. And they actually staged quite a few protests and are responsible for some of the tarring and feathering of some tax agents that are sent from the crown. So certainly their activities are not exclusively things that you may personally participate in. All right. And this would be one of those causes for debate. If the Sons of Liberty, if you lived in 1773 in colonial Boston, would you yourself be a member of the Sons of Liberty? Step further, would you carry out the actions that the Sons of Liberty endorsed or organized? Well, Only you can answer that question. Okay. But they're going to organize a demonstration, and on the evening of December 16th, you have a bunch of American Bostonians, American colonists, dressed up as Mohawk Indians. They're not like trying to pass themselves. It's more of a funny thing that is actually saying, oh, the Indians did it, not the Bostonians. The British would never believe that Mohawks entered the city of Boston and threw tea into the harbor. It was just a funny, let's dress up like Mohawk Indians. We'll hoop and holler and make a lot of noise, and we're going to throw these chests into the harbor. So you have 342 chests of tea that have been sitting in Boston Harbor for quite a while, several weeks, because the colonists are not going to buy British tea, right? They're protesting. There's a boycott of British goods. So it's just sitting there, and they're like, hey, let's go check this into the Boston Harbor, and we'll have a great time. Important thing to realize, and I mentioned this before, I think it was 2 weeks ago, this is not Antifa, BLM looting and destruction of goods, okay? First of all, the only damage that was done was to the lock that was on the harbor gate. So you're going to have to bust the lock to get into the harbor. So they break the lock, they get into the harbor, and the tea, of course. I suppose if you're British, maybe you would still drink it, but you're not going to drink that tea anymore. It's no good. So that's destroyed, thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage to the tea. Okay, but that's the only damage. They're not burning the ships. They're not killing people. They're not beating anybody up. The captains of the ship or the people that are in the harbor, they allow this to take place. The demonstration is effective in that it gets the message across to the British. Hey, this tax-free monopoly you've given them, it's not okay with us. Another important point here is that Ben Franklin and many of the other leaders of the independence movement, or those that supported independence, ultimately, not in 1773 by any means, but ultimately, so people like John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, those types of people supported the idea that the British East India Company be reimbursed, and Ben Franklin offers to pay for it personally. So they understand the importance of the action, the demonstration, to say the tea is going to be thrown into the harbor. But do you have, so BLM as an organization is making millions and millions of dollars off of donations and all other sorts of ways that organizations like that make money. Are they offering to go back to those communities and pay those business owners? No, so it's not about the demonstration. It's about the destruction and the theft of property. This wasn't about the theft of property. This was about sending a message and saying, this is a very strong message that we're saying that what you're doing is wrong. And so as a result, we're going to throw the tea into the harbor and we'll reimburse you for it. But you need to understand the message that it's not okay that you're doing this. So the actual legality of the Boston Tea Party is probably in question. Right, we could say in some respects they're trespassing and they're destroying private property. Maybe not the best legal route. However, in that specific circumstance, everything that surrounds the Boston Tea Party is responded to correctly by the colonists and other leaders of the independence movement. Okay, so while the legality of the Boston Tea Party is probably not something that we ourselves would participate in, we would certainly be of the mind to say, we're going, because that happened, we support the message that it sent, and we're also going to do everything we can to make sure that you understand that we're not just destroying things to destroy it. And that's a very important distinction to make when you're looking at the Boston Tea Party, is the response. Okay, so maybe this was wrong, maybe this is something that shouldn't have taken place, but we're doing everything we can to repay the British East India Company, and we're also going to make sure that you know nobody gets hurt in this demonstration and so forth. And that point is exactly what I talked about just now. So I'm not sure what the are these the.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I have one in front of me, it kind of helps me to. You know, so the colonists' hatred of tea monopoly and taxes. For letter A, and then Benjamin Franklin is the one who insisted that the East India Company be reimbursed. The way the British East India Companies and the Dutch East India Trading Company works is very odd to us. This is an independent company that operates outside of the actual government of the country. So it operates as a separate entity. It's a sovereign company, which is very odd to think about. So the British East India Company operates outside of the actual British government and operates as its own sovereign nation almost. So it has its own navy, it has its own soldiers, it employs its own people, and it's responsible for its own well-being. The government's not supporting it or propping it up. Same thing with the Dutch East India Trading Company. Now, the reason for this is the expediency of business, because during this time, information moves so slow. So if you want companies to grow, they're going to have to operate outside of the approval of certain government agencies. Think about back in like the 1600s when the Dutch East India Trading Company is operating in like the Indian Ocean and trading with the Mughal Empire in India and along the western or eastern coast of Africa. They don't necessarily have time to write the Dutch government and say, hey, we need a coastal city. We're going to attack it and take it. Do we have your permission? Okay, well then 3 months later, they're going to get back to them. So what the government's doing is allowing them to operate. Just handle it yourself. Form your own navy, form your own armies, support your own trading routes, protect all of that yourself, but it's the Dutch East India Trading Company. Same thing with the British East India Trading Company. So that, hopefully that helps you understand a little bit of what type of company that is. It's very, there's a lot of corruption within those companies. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the British, so their trading companies will operate in the Caribbean too, quite a bit, and all of their colonies that are there. But yeah, it's mostly just the expedience of allowing a company to operate. Now, the other thing you have to realize is that if it's the British East India Trading Company, they have to have the support of the British government, at least in some loose sort of way, because that's the market. They're using the British market to then get their goods out to the rest of the world. So they're not going to operate opposite of the interests of the British government, but they're going to carry out their actions and what they think is going to be the best for them as a company, as opposed to saying, I wonder what King George III would think about this. So again, a little bit complicated, but you know, it's a sign of the times. Okay? They didn't have quick communication. They had to be able to make decisions just that quick. Let's talk about martial law in Boston following the Tea Party. So following the Tea Party, you have more British troops that are sent over. British troops have actually occupied the city of Boston for quite a while, ever since the Stamp Act, ever since Boston back in late 1760s was the first time that the British actually sent troops over to Boston to enforce peace. So imagine the city of Boston today being like the hotbed for American patriotism. Would not think about that today. Maybe like Wichita, Kansas, but not Boston, Massachusetts. So the British troops are there, and this is just going to begin in earnest after the Boston Tea Party. So you have curfews that are established. The army is essentially enforcing the law of the city. So once the army becomes a police force, that is martial law. The idea of a police force is actually a relatively new one to humanity, having a group of people whose only job it is to enforce the law. So even in a lot of colonial cities during this time, you don't have a quote-unquote police force. You just have people who whose responsibility it is to kind of generally keep the peace. So you may have like a peace officer or somebody in the town whose job it is to carry out arrests, but they're not patrolling, they're not writing citations, all right? It isn't this force that just kind of has a presence. That mostly, during this time, is thought about as an occupation. If you have a group of professional people whose only job it is, through the use of force, to enforce the law, that's more of an occupation. So it's interesting how, as Americans, we completely accept the power and the occupation of the Greeley Police Department, when in a lot of past human societies, they would see that as an occupation of a military force. that's enforcing the law on them. Something to think about. So the colonists are forced to board soldiers. And this is more like colonial cities. I think I changed that on the notes. No, I did change it, and then I made that one of the blanks. So you can put colonists, because it is still the responsibility of the colonists to find housing. But from what I've researched, this is not British troops that are staying with colonists. Now, that may have taken place, but it's more like, is there a vacant building on your property? If there is a vacant building on your property, then the British can seize that building and house soldiers there. That still is an issue, and that still is the quartering of soldiers. All right, so don't think that specifically for it to be the quartering of soldiers, that's part of the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. You cannot quarter soldiers on private property. There has to be a specific military area. If the federal government owns land, then the federal government can build a fort on that land and house soldiers there and not among us. Right? And that is for our security. But if you have an empty outbuilding, a shed on your property that's not being used in Boston during this time, well, we can seize that, and if it's fit for housing, we'll put soldiers there. Wouldn't you still have a problem with that? Absolutely, you would. So growing up, I always thought that this was soldiers staying with families, much like missionaries might stay with a family while they're visiting a church, but that's not what's taking place. And there is no law against quartering missionaries, so feel free to do that. Yeah, exactly. I put this here to just kind of help you understand what's happening in order. So we talked about the Townshend Act and the protests there. After the Townshend Act, you have the Boston Massacre. And this is, once again, a great example of something that we would probably not participate in, the protests that were happening during the night of the Boston Massacre. But the response is what's the most important thing. So you have a group of Bostonians that are very upset about the Townshend Acts. They're protesting, and they're harassing a group of British soldiers. And they're throwing rocks and snowballs at this group of soldiers. And at one point, it becomes so aggressive, the exchange of force between these two sides becomes so aggressive that a shot is fired by a British soldier into the crowd. Well, at that point, the rest of the British soldiers fire their weapons as well, and you have, I believe it's three or five that are killed. Boston, is it five? So not really a massacre, but certainly that terminology is going to fire up a lot of Americans at the time, and could be labeled a massacre for the simple fact that those colonists are not armed. They have no way to return fire against the British garrison. So whose fault is it? We don't know. Is it the fault of the colonists for being so aggressive towards the garrison that they felt like they needed to fire? Because an order was never given to fire into the crowd. A British officer never gave that order. But the firing happened, and other soldiers fired. So what happens after that? Oh, those British soldiers get lynched, right? No. No, John Adams defends those soldiers in a court of law and gets them off the hook. I think the worst charge that they received was manslaughter, and one of the soldiers was branded on the hand. That's it. No jail time, nothing. So again, when you, and this is, I've seen this firsthand in interviews with Black Lives Matter supporters. The United States was founded on burning and looting and protesting. No, it was not. Okay. Even responses to things that are in legal question, like the protest on the night of the Boston Massacre, were responded to by the leaders of the American Revolution as, no, there has to be legal ramifications here. And what the Founding Fathers decided was that the British soldiers were actually justified in firing at that group. And that given the situation and giving the threat to their own lives, that they did have the right to stand their ground and if need be, use deadly force against that group. So if we're true Americans and you really do support the Founding Fathers, the night of the Boston Massacre, you would say, well, that British garrison probably should have fired on that rowdy group of colonists. And it was their legal right to defend themselves in that situation. So consistency is the one thing with our Founding Fathers that is so important. Even when it doesn't help their cause, they're consistent. So you have John Adams here saying, no, under the rule of law, which is what is so paramount to us, these soldiers acted the best way they could in the face of this, and we're just going to charge one of these soldiers with manslaughter. The night of the Boston Tea Party, the response by the leaders of this movement is what? There's legal question as to whether or not this was right, and so we're going to do everything in our power to make it right. There's things that we have to do to say legally this is a legal response to actions that are otherwise in moral and legal question. So that's what's most important to take away from the Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre. After the Boston Tea Party, the Intolerable Acts are passed. These are the coercive acts. Let's take a look at those. I'm just going to put all this info up at the same time. So the first thing that it did, and this is going to be essentially what prompts war. It closes the port of Boston. Remember, this is after the Boston Tea Party. It expands the governing powers of General Thomas Gage. Wait, the governor of Massachusetts, or the governor of Boston at the time, is a British general? Is that legal? Granted legal protection to British officers, which is much like the legal protection that's afforded to our police officers, that a lot of people want to strip away, or they could potentially be sued by families for using deadly force or violent force against people. Currently, I believe the law is still in place that protects them, so this is very similar to that. It renews the Quartering Act, which was allowed to become void, but it renews that, and now they can stay in any unoccupied building, as we talked about before, and this is what leads to the First Continental Congress. And I believe that's continued on the back. So you have Roman numeral 4 there, renewed the Quartering Act. And that's at the top of the flip side. The one thing that I did want to point out, and I hope this doesn't get too far down a rabbit trail, post-Napoleonic Europe, which is going to be about 50 years after the time period that we're looking at now, I think is very emblematic of the approach that the British government takes and that the rest of Europe takes after Napoleon. We'll get into this a little bit more when we compare the French Revolution and the British Revolution. After Napoleon, the whole continent of Europe, so all those Western countries, the Germanic countries, France, Italy, the Netherlands, Britain, Austria, I believe Russia was here at this Congress. You have the Congress of Vienna, and they meet for a very long time. It's like 10 months. And they decide, what are we going to do now that Napoleon is exiled to Elba and he can't run rampant in Europe? And I think this is around 1820. Okay. During the Congress of Vienna, they decide that there can be no more revolutions. And the Austrian foreign minister, Metternich, is responsible for coming up with this policy. He says, what you Western countries, European countries, need to do is whenever you get the whiff of rebellion or an independence movement, you need to crush it ruthlessly. Okay, so don't compromise at all. Okay, there can be no compromise when your country wants to overthrow the monarchy and establish their own country. Why would they take that approach? Because of what they saw happen in France. France staged a revolution. They beheaded their king. They beheaded thousands of people in Paris during the Reign of Terror. And that leads to a vacuum of power in France, which is one of the most powerful countries in Europe, that Napoleon could just fill. And Napoleon is this aggressive, imperialistic guy who wants to took over most of Europe and was a scourge to a lot of the other European countries at the time, including the country Metternich was from, Austria. So what I see here is kind of what leads to that sort of ideology. Whenever you get the whiff of independence, which at this time is still not really on the American colonists' mind, they don't want independence yet. They just want to be heard, and they want representation. And instead of saying, how can we better represent the American colonists that are making the British government a ton of money at this time, they say, no, we're going to crush them. And the Intolerable Acts are called the Coercive Acts by the British because they're meant to coerce Boston into following the law. Well, what's going to happen when you have a group of people who already feel underrepresented, who are already on the verge of using violence to get their point across, and you try to crush them with your heel? The resistance is not going to go down, it's going to get worse. And so now the people of Massachusetts and the people of Boston, who have been declared in a state of rebellion against the crown, they're like, whoa, we're not in a state of rebellion against the crown. We've staged a couple of protests and there's been some skirmishes, some issues, but we're not in a state of rebellion. Now they feel threatened because the city, the biggest city in Massachusetts and one of the biggest cities in the colonies, Boston, is now being occupied by a military force. And that's going to be a major problem for them. Okay, vice admiralty courts are going to be important. I'm going through all of this because next week I'm going to read the Declaration of Independence. We're going to read the whole thing. It's not very long. Not next week, sorry. That would be so cool if we could read it. Can you read the Declaration of Independence? Because if you read the Declaration of Independence, what's going to happen is you're going to go, oh, Brandon talked about that. Oh, he talked about that, quartering of troops. So now we're going to talk about vice admiralty courts very quickly. So the Currency Act, which you already know about, generally speaking, it also allows courts to rule over maritime matters. These are matters of like smuggling or not paying duties. Any crime that happens on the seas, those are maritime matters. Typically, most of these issues were solved in common law courts. So you broke the law, you didn't pay your duty, or you're smuggling illegal goods, you're going to go to a court. There's going to be a judge, there's going to be a jury of your peers, they're going to hand down a punishment, that's going to be it. And common law courts are all throughout the colonies. So you're just going to go to whatever common law court is the closest to you and stand trial, just like you would be familiar with today with our court system. The Vice Admiralty Court is located in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I'm going to advance my slides here because I have a map. Yes. Yeah, the way they're set up is more like military courts as opposed to civilian courts, and we're going to talk about why. So along the eastern seaboard of the United States, not Florida, this is a Spanish territory, but Georgia is one of the colonies, and of course you have the Carolinas and Virginia, and then the New England territories. Nova Scotia is right here, and Halifax is like right there. So Maine is actually not one of the original 13 colonies. I don't know if you knew that, but so this is not, and during this time, the territory of Maine that's inhabited by Americans is much smaller. So you're going to have to go all the way up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, if you're committed, if you're accused of any maritime crime. So these courts, this court specifically, began to try matters that were previously not an issue. Okay, so maybe you smuggled something from that you got from another trader. You smuggled it through the port of Boston. It was a good that was not properly paid for, or was not on your ship's tender, and you get caught. So you go to the court in Boston. They hand down a punishment, probably just a fine, and then you go free and you continue to operate your business. And you think twice the next time you want to smuggle something in. Well, now you have to go all the way to Nova Scotia. And this court, I haven't been able to confirm through a primary source, but it appears through my research that this court is going to try exclusively colonists and not the British merchants who are operating in the exact same area. It looks like the British merchants will usually be... when somebody is convicted of a crime in the United States, but they're in a different country? Extradite. So a lot of times we'll have extradition of British merchants from the colonies to Britain, and they get tried in British common law courts, not the Vice Admiralty courts. So it's interesting you have this very obvious legal issue here, because if an American colonist breaks the law, go to Nova Scotia. If a British merchant breaks the law, oh, go back to Britain. Why is that significant? The Vice Admiralty courts don't have a jury. They have a judge, one single judge. So you think that the punishments are going to be a lot more severe? They are, absolutely. And this is how it operates a little bit more like a military court. This is interesting. Failure to appear results in automatic guilt. So it's not like a warrant where you can say we have a warrant for somebody's arrest. They've been accused of a crime. We don't know where they are, so we're going to put out a warrant. If there's a warrant for someone's arrest, does that mean that they're automatically guilty? No. Oh, you missed a court date, so you're guilty. That's not how it works. We're going to go arrest you, we're going to find you, and we're going to force you to appear in court, but you're not automatically guilty. It's not like we say, oh, somebody's on the loose that we suspect of a murder, but his court date was such and such, and now he's automatically guilty, life sentence, go pick him up and throw him in jail. He still has his day in court. Yes?
Don't we still kind of do that, though, in small claims courts and stuff today? If the defendant does not show up, they are considered guilty and you need to pay up. And if the plaintiff does not show up, then it's just dismissed. But don't we kind of do that?
I think that in certain circumstances, that's probably the case. But, I mean, if you're talking about just like, a civil court, you're trying matters that are mostly just disputes. You know, I don't know if you guys have watched like Judge Judy. Those disputes usually, it's like what, $1,000? You know, so those people aren't even represented by lawyers. But if you're talking about being accused of smuggling, those punishments can range from a slap on the wrist to jail time. And if you don't show up in Nova Scotia, you think it's hard for somebody that's a merchant in Georgia who's hauling rice out of Georgia? Oh, you've been accused of, and this guy, well, I don't know what I'm accused of. You're accusing me of something? I mean, maybe he's innocent. Maybe he's even guilty. But he's got to sail all the way up to Nova Scotia from Georgia? Nobody's going to be able to do that. So you have an example of the government almost wanting there to be criminals. And this is not the reason that laws are passed. We would be much better off if we had representatives today who understood what laws are about. If your law immediately makes law-abiding citizens criminals, then rethink the law. This is the issue that I have with like magazine bans. This is not even an argument about whether or not you think 30-round magazines should be legal or not. This is an argument of instantly, overnight, creating thousands of criminals in your state. And you say, well, they're grandfathered in. Okay, but otherwise they're law-abiding citizens. You're still making their actions illegal from the passage of a law. And this, it's the same problem that you said with prohibition. Most of us in this room would go, it would be great if there was no drunkenness.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask also, was this one of the antecedents to us having a strong due process written into the?
Absolutely. It absolutely is. Because the Vice Admiralty courts take from colonial courts cases that they would try. And legal jurisdiction has been granted by the laws, by the charters that are given to these colonies to rule in these cases. And the Vice Admiralty courts come in and say, nope, it's all ours now. Under what legal standing? Well, we passed the Currency Act. Well, where did that pass? Parliament. Which is where? London. You go, well, all of a sudden you're changing all the laws. We had a charter. We have courts that have operated for, in some cases, hundreds of years, or at least over 100 years. And now all of a sudden, the entire legal system is overthrown because you've decided that all of the American smugglers or people that are accused of smugglers have to go to Halifax, Nova Scotia, to these essentially military courts. It's pointed out in the Declaration of Independence. I believe this isn't a direct quote, but, I don't want to misquote it. So let's move on. Lexington and Concord, quickly. So number four there, Lexington and Concord. So this is the first, this is what sets off the American Revolution. So historians sometimes debate over when wars actually start. There's pretty little debate that this is the actual beginning of hostilities between these two sides. So the British troops in Boston are going to get information that there's an armory in Lexington, Massachusetts, and that separatists may use those weapons to challenge the occupation of Boston. So Lexington, Massachusetts during this time, you can think of it kind of like an outskirt. Of course, Boston during this time is very much smaller than it is today. So you'd have to march into the Massachusetts countryside. The garrison is going to march on Lexington, but this is where you have the writing of Paul Revere, William Dawes, and Samuel Prescott. Those three writers, Paul Revere being the most famous because of who writes the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere? Is it Longfellow? It is Longfellow. Okay, that's what I thought, but I didn't want to say incorrectly. That poem makes Paul Revere famous, while Dawes and Prescott don't get as much of the publicity. I guess more rhymes with Revere than Dawes or Prescott, which it does. I was just thinking through it. Probably be hard to write that poem.
Are you going to get to it, or why are you calling this the infamous ride?
So it's infamous because of...
To the colonists.
To the colonists. And to the British, actually. Because we all know about the Old North Church, one if by land, two if by sea. So this is what's taking place. So a lot of times with the American Revolution, I don't know about you guys, but for me, I get everything out of order. My timeline of the American Revolution is messed up. You go, okay, so when Boston is first occupied by the British, is that when Paul Revere hangs the lanterns? No, it's during this. It's 1775, prior to the battle, the day previous, I believe it's April 18th. The night previous, Revere, Dawes, and Prescott are alerting the Minutemen, along the Massachusetts countryside that the British are coming to take the weapons at the armory in Lexington. One if by land, two if by sea. Because they can come upriver or they can come by land. Right?
So why is it called infamous?
It's infamous because of the poem. It's infamous because of its legendary status among Americans, the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. Did I use that word wrong?
Yeah, it's more famous. Infamous implies that this was wrong, that it was not good.
I have a different understanding of the word.
Yeah, maybe I'm misunderstanding something. Did all three of them get captured and arrested before they really got anything good?
Hold on. And... there you go. The famous writer of Paul Revere. Fixed it. Just for you. I said it was famous. I was trying to get across that it's legendary. Everyone knows about the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. People learn about it in like first grade. But Megan, I think you said Paul Revere did not finish the ride. Neither did William Dawes. Samuel Prescott is the only one who actually finishes the entire ride and gets to the end point. So the battles of Lexington and Concord, you have some questions that come about. So first of all, I'm going to kind of set the stage here. Lexington and Concord, British garrison marching into Lexington, but the Minutemen know that the British are coming because of Revere, Dawes, and Prescott. So they're able to prepare, they're armed themselves, they know that they're coming. They get to Lexington, and they're met with resistance. Light resistance, but shots are fired. In the exchange of fire, one British soldier is injured, 8 colonists are killed, 9 more injured. The reason these battles were grouped together, though, is because they immediately marched then to Concord, and at Concord, they begin to set fire to parts of the city. The fire gets sort of out of control, and the militiamen who are stationed outside of Concord, close to the Concord Bridge, believe that the entire city is in flames. And they attack the British that are guarding the bridge at Concord, thinking that they're burning the entire city. The British are forced to retreat at Concord Bridge, and so the battles of Lexington and Concord, if we're grouping them together, is the first battle of the American Revolution. It's also a victory for the American colonists, because the British are forced to then march back to Boston along the road, suffering what they would consider cheap shots from colonists that are just sort of staging guerrilla warfare along the road, hiding behind trees, taking shots, so forth. Yes? So the shot heard around the world is actually not considered the first shot of the American Revolution. It's the shot at Concord Bridge, and we still don't know who fired that. If it was the British troops that were guarding the bridge who fired at the colonists, or the colonists that fired at the British. If it is true that the American colonists, who are probably from Concord, Massachusetts, believe that their city was burning, it seems like it would be legitimate to say that it's probably an American that fired at the British. And in that case, I would say you're justified. If you're burning my property, you're burning my home, I have then, and we've already seen that, you have the ability to use force to protect yourself. So, okay, justification. Do the colonists on the Massachusetts countryside have a legal ability to control or to have a militia and therefore to have an armory? And do the British have a right, a legal right, to then go seize that armory and take those weapons? Because that's what the battle is about. So if this is the first battle, what is the foundation that the American Revolution is based upon? Who has the right to do what? Do the British have a right to take the weapons, or do the Americans have a right to have the weapons? If the Americans have a legal right or to have those weapons and to have a militia, then they're legally justified in resisting the opposite side, who is then disobeying the law by seizing the weapons. You understand that? So, important distinction here. If I own several firearms, if the ATF comes to my house and says, you have to give up your weapons, all of your weapons, give them to us right now, under threat of force, the Second Amendment has not been annulled, correct? Let's just assume that it hasn't. Do I have the right, as an American citizen, to then resist that illegal confiscation of my property with violent force? I'm not going to give you that answer. But that's exactly what you're looking at here. And this is why Americans are so protective of their firearms. That militia was established in Massachusetts to protect the people of Massachusetts from Indian attacks. And they believed... It was legally established. They had every right to own those weapons. They had every right to defend themselves. And in their minds, an illegal British occupation that was staged contrary to the Petition of Right and to the British Bill of Rights, those British soldiers were disobeying British law by marching to their city and demanding that they give up their weapons.
Is it an arbitrary seizure? That's a question that's been burning. Because I know.
Is it a what?
Was it an arbitrary decision on the part of the British to seize the armory? Because I think you're right.
I mean, I don't think it was arbitrary. I think they felt threatened by the fact that they knew that there was an armory and a militia there while they were occupying Boston.
Yeah, well, what I meant was that did the general make an arbitrary decision to seize it, believing he was being threatened without cause? Was there really a cause for him to feel that they were threatened?
Oh, like, were there any threats coming that they were going to retake Boston? Not that I know of.
Yeah, and see, and that's been, I see the world as because a bit of a puzzle. But in a way, it's not. They're still under British rule. They're British subjects. They've established a legal cache of arms for their militia. But someone implied there was a threat and made a move to seize that. And that to me is...
Well, I think you also have to look at, okay, big picture stuff. Are the people of Massachusetts in an open state of rebellion against the crown? Because King George says, yes, they are, and he declares them such to Parliament. But the people of Massachusetts say, no, we're not. So how can a government say, you're in an open state of rebellion, when the people themselves don't even say they're in rebellion? Wouldn't you typically think that it would be not opposite, but wouldn't that declaration of rebellion come from the people who are supposedly rebelling? Like, why would they debate with the king about whether or not they were in rebellion? That, to me, doesn't make any sense. So you have the olive branch petition that's sent to the king. You have all of these offers of peace and reconciliation and wanting to fix things, and then you still have the British garrison that marches under the Massachusetts countryside. That seems to me, because the people that are on that countryside, it's the 1775. Nobody signed the Declaration of Independence. Continental Congress has met, but they haven't talked about independence necessarily, or at least not to the point where it's a sure thing. So in my mind, if it's me and I live in Lexington in 1775, I know that I have a legal right to be a part of a militia and that I have a legal right to own those guns. And so I think that they are legally justified in the Battle of Lexington and Concord. Okay, I think we'll get big picture stuff of like whether or not the whole American Revolution was justified, but I think in this specific, I think the historical sources and the data that I've seen supports the fact that the colonists were not the aggressors in this situation. They were not marching to Boston to overthrow British occupation, were they? Who is marching to whose property? And that's another thing that, you know, law officers would look at. Who is trespassing? Who is prompting the use of force? And I think that's a big question.
Two
comment?
Things. Number one, remember this. When I get into my sessions, do you have a right to defend yourself scripturally? So remember this. This is good. Number two, Brandon, I've got a question. The legal part of them actually having a cache of arms, you said that that was legal?
They were not illegally owning weapons.
Okay. I didn't know if the British had passed something.
There are militias established all around the British colonies. Or the American colonies. I think it would be interesting to look at who establishes those, whether it's the colonial governments or even if it's the British government, because how do the colonists fight alongside the British in the French and Indian War if they don't have their own trained militia, if they don't have their own weapons? Those militias are established. Wouldn't the British want the American colonists to defend themselves as opposed to saying, oh, now we got to station redcoats at every single frontier point along the entire eastern seaboard just in case there's an Indian attack? No, colonists, you defend yourselves. But yeah, those are legally, they have a right to have those, and those militias are not for overthrowing the British at all.
That's significant.
Those militias have existed for a long time up to this point, that these colonists established militias to provide security for their city in the case of most likely an Indian attack or just general security, French or et cetera, that are kind of closing in on them at this point, or they feel like they are. Yes?
Just another thing that the geography of Boston at this time is a little bit different.
Yeah.
As far as I've read, that also made the people of Boston feel a little bit more oppressed, I'd say, because they were kind of out in the middle of the harbor, weren't they, with only, it was called the Neck, a piece of land. So the British really could keep an eye on who was in Boston, who was out, and what came into the city and what out.
Yeah, so you have an area... We're going kind of long. You have an area around Boston that I think is called Boston Heights. And it's the hills around Boston that is today part of the city proper. But during this time was basically just countryside. The Battle of Bunker Hill is on one of the hills overlooking Boston. Americans get dug in after war is declared. They get dug in at Bunker Hill. And the British are like, well, you can't be there. For the precise reason that you just pointed out, is that you can overlook the entire city of Boston. And if you have the high ground in the military, if the American colonists can control the hills around Boston, then yeah, they could stage an attack and then oust the British there. Okay, we need to close, so let's pray. And next week, battles and leaders during the American Revolution.